Thanks a lot for the invitation. Maybe I'll just move up to the other side. Since the screen is closer. Sorry. All right, so I'll be talking about work that I've done with a bunch of people. I'll be focusing mostly on this paper that I wrote with Damon Binder, Shai Chester, and Yifan Wang, although I'll mention results from these other papers with also with Xi'an, and I guess Damon and Shai are on this paper too. Okay, so in the last 20 years, there's been a lot of work on ADS-CFT, and this work has been using ADS-CFT, or the gauge gravity duality, in one of two ways. The first one would be to learn about quantum gravity or string theory or M theory from the CFT by doing CFT calculations. And the other one is the opposite one, which is to learn about strongly interacting quantum field theories by using the bulk. Each of these ways has its own challenges. The challenge for the first one is that doing CFT calculations in theories with holographic duals is hard because these CFTs are strongly coupled, so the calculations are almost impossible. And the challenge for the second one is that while most of the work that has been done involves gravity or supergravity in the bulk, not much is known about string theory or M theory in entity de Sitter space beyond the supergravity approximation, beyond the tree level supergravity approximation. Not much has been done involving loops either. And in this talk, I will use a bunch of techniques, most importantly, analytic bootstrap and supersymmetric localization, to explore ADS-CFT beyond the supergravity approximation. And there will be some new results about holographic correlators that come from this. So even though not much is known about string theory beyond the supergravity approximation, so we'll sort of overcome this and still be able to do calculations. So as far as the first two bullet points are concerned, this talk will have something to say, well, mostly about learning about quantum field theories from the bulk, even though not much is known. But we should also have in mind the first bullet point, because eventually this type of approach will hopefully give us something new about quantum gravity or string theory or M theory. So what kind of ADS-CFT will I be talking about? I'll be talking about what I think are the most well-established examples. The first one is the duality between 4D n equal 4 super-Yang-Mills theory with SUN gauge group at large n and large TUF coupling. The TUF coupling is G Yang-Mills squared n, where G Yang-Mills is the Yang-Mills coupling. And this is dual to type 2B string theory on ADS5 times S5 at large n, at leading order large n and large lambda, we have classical supergravity in the bulk. And the other example would be a 3D ABJM theory, which is a gauge theory with UN, two UN gauge groups and Chern-Simons interactions, which at large n and fixed k is dual to M theory on ADS4 times S7 mod ZK. Most of this talk will be about n equal 4 super Yang-Mills, about the first one. And I will explain in a bit why I'm doing that. I could have equally well given a talk about focused mostly on the ABJM part. Okay? But I can tell you now, the formulas are a little simpler for the 4D n equal 4 super Yang-Mills case. Okay, so the talk is about computing holographic correlators. Holographic And one of the main ideas that sort of makes this possible is that holographic correlators are simple in Mellin space, and I'll explain what Mellin space is shortly. By simple, I mean that the holographic correlators have nice properties in Mellin space, and the properties can be used to figure out what the correlators are. So they can be used to bootstrap the correlators. And another property of these holographic correlators that will appear in this talk is that one can take a certain flat space limit, and I will describe what that is, whereby one can extract from a CFT correlator, one can extract flat space scattering amplitudes on the dual side. So on the dual side, we have, for instance, string theory on ADS 5 times S5. If we send the radius of ADS to infinity, we get flat space, and we'll be able to extract scattering amplitudes in flat space by taking L to infinity. So this is a cartoon of that. This is ADS as a cylinder. The CFT is on the boundary. And the idea is that with four boundary operators, we can create wave packets that will then go inside ADS and scatter, say, close to this point. So the CFT correlator should include this information about the scattering process. And if we take the radius of ADS to infinity, or equivalently, if we take the energies of these particles to be very large, then the curvature doesn't matter. And the scattering process would be a flat space scattering process. This is just a picture. I will say in detail what the formulas are that go along with this picture. So let me explain that. So as an example, let's say we have four operators, O sub I, where I goes from 1 to 4. And for simplicity, let them have the same scaling dimension delta. So delta I is equal to delta. This is a conformal field theory. So in a CFT, a four-point function of four operators of dimension delta has this prefactor that accounts for the overall scaling dimension. So 1 over x12 to the 2 delta, x34 to the 2 delta, and then it's a function of U and V, where U and V are the conformally invariant cross ratios formed by these four points, x1, x2, x3, and x4. So this is general formula in a conformal field theory. Now, we can either say what this, in order to specify the four-point function, we can either say what G of U and V is, or we can say what the Mellin transform is. And the relation between G of U and V and the Mellin transform is given by this equation over here. So the connected part of the four-point function is some integral over two Mellin space variables, which I'll call S and T. And then there's the conformal cross ratio U to some power, V to some other power, and then a bunch of gamma functions, and then the Mellin amplitude, which is this M of S and T. Here, in this formula, there's also a U that appears, little u, and that's related to S and T by this relation, S plus T plus U is 4 delta. So these S and T and U are the Mellin space analogs of the Mandelstam variables. That's the reason why they're denoted by S and T and U. We can also go, so if we know M of S and T, we can figure out G, and if we know G, there's an inversion formula, we can go from G to M as well. So either specify G or specify M is the same thing. All right. Now, the reason for this complicated definition with these gamma functions is that with this definition, the Mellin amplitude has very nice properties as follows. So it has a nice analytic, the first property is that it has a nice analytic structure. The analytic structure is as follows. Contact Witten diagrams. So for Witten diagrams, we can have contact Witten diagrams. We're just integrating over a point in ADS. We can have exchange diagrams like this. Or we can have loop diagrams like that. Contact Witten diagrams give polynomial Mellin amplitudes in S and T of degree equal to the number of derivatives in the interaction vertex divided by 2. So this is This is one reason why this definition is nice, because with this definition, contact Witten diagrams give polynomial m's. And the degree of the polynomial is related to the order of the derivative order of the interaction vertex. And exchange Witten, so this is a contact Witten diagram, exchange Witten diagrams give Mellin amplitudes with poles, and it's understood what the poles are, where the poles are and what the residues of the poles are. So for example, if we have an S-channel exchange, like something that's drawn here, and suppose that the field that's being exchanged is a scalar field. Now a scalar field in ADS would be dual to some operator of some dimension, delta exchanged, and the Mellin amplitude that comes from this tree-level Witten diagram has poles at S equals delta exchange plus 2n, where n is an integer. So it's understood where the poles are, and it's understood what the residues of the poles are. In this talk, I won't say much about loop amplitudes. So we'll just focus on tree level. For tree level, change diagrams have poles. Contact Witten diagrams are just polynomials in S and T. Give m's that are polynomials in S and T. And the other interesting property of these Mellin amplitudes is that from them, as I said before, one can recover the flat space scattering amplitude. So the relation between the flat space amplitude and the Mellin amplitude is given by this equation. We take the Mellin amplitude. So if we want the scattering amplitude at some values, capital S and capital T of the Mandelstam variables, capital S and capital T would be Mandelstam variables for the scattering process, then we take the Mellin amplitude, we evaluate it at L squared S divided by 2 alpha and L squared T divided by 2 alpha. L is the radius of ADS. Alpha is just an integration variable. And then we integrate it with this weight. This is a contour integral where the contour goes parallel to the, runs parallel to the imaginary axis. And then we take the limit where L goes to infinity. And that's the scattering amplitude. This is a scattering amplitude of massless particles in flat space. And it's massless particles because in ADS, the mass, so the ADS-CFT dictionary says that the mass of the particle is related to the scaling dimension of the operator by this relation. So m squared is delta times delta minus d divided by l squared. And if we take l to infinity, then the mass goes to zero. So we're going to get scattering of massless particles in flat space. Here, S and T are the Mandelstam invariants, and U, one can define U as well as minus S minus T for massless particles. Okay? So you see that from this equation, it's clear that it's only the leading term in M at large little s and little t, so this is this quantity here is little s, the Mandelstam, the Mellin space variable little s, and this is little t. Because we're taking L to infinity, is just the leading term in M at large as arguments that contributes to the flat space scattering amplitude. So this formula implies that the leading order, at leading order in large S and T, the Mellin amplitude is proportional to the flat space scattering amplitude. And in particular, M of S and T has the same growth at large S and T as the flat space scattering amplitude. Yes?
Is there some order of limits where you can obtain the scattering amplitude for massive particles in flat space?
To obtain massive particles in flat space? Yeah, I think so. To do that, you'd have to consider dimensions of, you have to consider changing the dimension of the operators you take the limit, such that you keep M fixed. So if you have a family of such operators, then you can take the dimension to scale with, to be proportional to L, and then you get massive particles. So this should also work for that. I will not be doing that in this talk. I'll just be doing massless particles. You're good? So if there are some other quantum numbers of the operators, I will keep those fixed as well as we take L to infinity. And what that's going to do is that at the end of the day, we're going to end up with a scattering process where the momenta are restricted to lie within some subspace. The subspace corresponds to the ADS space whose radius of curvature we took to infinity. So for instance, if it's ADS 5 times S5, and we look at some operators with fixed scaling dimensions, and we take this flat space limit, we'll get a scattering amplitude in flat space in 10 dimensions where the momenta are restricted to lie within 5 dimensions. Okay. So now the procedure for computing holographic correlators, on one hand, if we have the Lagrangian, we can start computing Witten diagrams. So that would be one approach. And then another approach, which is what I'll do in this talk, is instead of computing Witten diagrams, use the properties that I just described in order to figure out what these Witten diagrams are. So instead of computing the Witten diagrams, use the analytic structure. So contact Witten diagrams give polynomial Mellin amplitudes, exchange diagrams give Mellin amplitudes with poles. So use the analytic structure, use the growth at large S and T of the Mellin amplitude. So we should have the exact same growth as the flat space scattering amplitude. So for instance, in a supergravity theory, which is a two derivative theory, then the Mellin amplitudes should grow linearly with S and T at large S and T. Use crossing symmetry, so we're computing some correlation function in a conformal field theory. You might have crossing symmetry, we should use that. If there's a theory that has supersymmetry, we should use supersymmetry. And the theories that I will be discussing have supersymmetry. So use all these properties to try to narrow down the set of possible Mellin amplitudes. And for 4D n equal 4 superangmillions, and also for 3D ABJM theory, these properties are sufficient to determine the Mellin amplitudes up to a few numerical constants. So the full functions of position will be completely determined. There will be only a few numerical constants that we'll have to determine. This would be order by order in the 1 over lambda expansion. Say at leading order in the 1 over n expansion, order by order in the 1 over lambda expansion. But each order will have a number of constants that need to be determined. The number of constants grows with the order in the expansion that we look at, but it'll just be a finite, at every order will be a finite number of numbers that we should compute. And once we compute those numbers, we know the holographic correlator up to that order. So I'll show this in detail. So now, okay, so we have the four-point function, up to a few numerical constants. How do we determine these constants? Well, in this talk, we'll determine these constants in one of two ways, or both ways. The one is the flat space limit. So here, when I did this general procedure, I only imposed the growth at large S and T for the Mellin amplitude. I didn't specify what coefficient that should have. But this should match a scattering amplitude in string theory where we actually know the coefficient, so one can also input that coefficient. And inputting that coefficient fixes some of these constants. And the other way to do it is using supersymmetric localization. One can see what constraints that imposes on these constants, and the connection between supersymmetric localization and these holographic correlators is by far not obvious. So I will explain that. Okay. So this is sort of the procedure. Are there any questions? Okay. So one can do this in a bunch of cases, and here I made a list of all the cases that we've studied. And so one can do this in 4D n equal 4 superangmills for half BPS operators. So for instance, for the scalar operators that belong to the same supermultiplet as the stress energy tensor, and from that, if we take the flat space limit, we get scattering amplitudes in 10 dimensions in type 2B string theory of the massless particles that correspond to the fields that are dual to these operators. So in this case, it would be the graviton in 10 dimensions and its super partners, or the lowest closed string states. One can do the same thing in the 6D 2,0 theory, also for half BPS operators. I won't talk about that at all. One can do this in a 3D ABJM theory. So ABJM theory, when K is 1 or 2, has N equal 8 supersymmetry. And the stress tensor multiplet is half BPS. So in this case, we again get scattering of gravitons and their superpartners in 11 dimensions, because in this case, the dual is 11 dimensional. And one can do the same thing in ABJM theory when K is bigger than 2. And from that, one can extract scattering amplitudes, or one can relate that to scattering of gravitons and their superpartners in M theory if we keep K fixed, or in type 2A string theory if we keep N over K fixed as we take N to infinity. So there's a bunch of cases. You can find these in our papers. What are the advantages and the disadvantages of various cases? Well, the advantage of the 4D case is that the formulas are a little bit simpler. So that's one reason why I'll focus on this. But the advantage of the 3D case, for instance, is that there are more supersymmetric localization constraints that one can use. So there's sort of a trade-off. But I'll focus mostly on this, and I'll mention results in 3D at the end. Okay. So, good. So we relate the CFT correlators to scattering amplitudes. Scattering amplitudes are determined from, or we can think of arising from some sort of effective action in 10 dimensions or 11 dimensions. So what does the effective action look like in 10D or 11D? Well, the leading order in the curvature in the derivative expansion, the two derivative theory is just supergravity, and you know, it's the Einstein-Hilbert term, and it has some supersymmetric completion. And then there are corrections to this that have more derivatives. So the next correction is a contraction of a product of four Riemann tensors. So it has 8 derivatives, and because it has 6 more derivatives than the Einstein-Hilbert term, it comes with a coefficient proportional to the string length to the 6th power. Then the next one is d to the 4, r to the 4, so 4 derivatives on 4 Riemann tensors, and so on. And these all come with their supersymmetric completions. Now, the catch is that, well, we know that this is what it should look like, but the precise form of the terms that have more than 2 derivatives, so even this Riemann to the 4 and its supersymmetric completion, this is not fully known. So now, if you think about computing holographic correlators by computing Witten diagrams at this order, then it's more or less impossible, because we don't even know what Witten diagrams to write down, because we don't know the interaction vertices. But nevertheless, I'll be able to tell you what the answer of those Witten diagram computations, what the answers are. They follow from the consistency conditions. But this isn't ADS yet. This is just flat space. And this gives a scattering amplitude that takes this form. So the scattering amplitude depends on the type of particle that's being scattered. So in 10 dimensions, we can scatter gravitons or their superpartners. And that's sort of what's encoded in this delta 16Q. And then supersymmetry implies that the form of the scattering amplitude is, so it depends on the type of particle that's being scattered, but all the non-trivial information is packaged in only one function of SNT, a scalar function of SNT. So the scattering amplitude looks like this, delta 16Q, and then there's a 1 over STU, and then there's a term that goes like LS to the 6 that comes from the R to the 4 interaction, and then there's a term that goes like S squared plus D squared plus U squared that comes from D to the 4, R to the 4, and so on, and they come from with various zeta functions. This formula is in Polchinski. In Polchinski's book, it's written as a ratio of gamma functions. It's known. So so this has an expansion in G, in the string coupling constant G string. So the leading order in GS, this formula is just some ratio of gamma functions. Is the type 2b analog of the Virasoro-Shapiro amplitude. And if you expand that in alpha prime, you get an expansion that looks like this with zeta functions. I can also write this as a tree-level supergravity answer, which is just the first term, times some function of S and T. So the function of S and T would just be this parenthesis multiplied by STU. So it just starts with a 1. So this is, I said this already, the full leading term in GS is a ratio of gamma functions found in Polchinski. This is in 10D. In 11D, the effective action is similar, except that the string length is replaced by the Planck length. And there's no string coupling. But in that case, it's not that we know all the terms. Only the terms up to order d to the 6 r to the 4th are known. Beyond that, nothing's known. So, if we could compute correlators in ABJM theory to a high enough order in the 1 over n expansion, we would learn new things about M theory, because we would learn what these couplings are beyond the d to the 6 r to the 4 order. So one can write this expansion where I first expanded in GS and then in L string times momentum. We can also write this expansion like this, where we keep G string fixed. Do G string fixed, and then we expand in L string. I think this formula is missing here on L string to the 6. So in this case, we can take this formula over here and the high order terms in G string, and then we can combine everything together and expand it at small stu. So the leading order is going to be this term. At next order is going to be this LS to the 6 term. But there are other terms that have other powers of GS that would also contribute at order LS to the 6. And we can package them all together and then so on. So famously, this next correction that goes like LS to the 6 is an Eisenstein series. The Eisenstein series is defined by this equation. It's just a sum over pairs of integers. And if you start then expanding this Eisenstein series, that's a small g string, it receives two perturbative corrections, the first of which being the one that gives this term, then the next one gives a term of order g string squared, and then it doesn't have any other perturbative corrections, it has only non-perturbative corrections. Okay. Well, this is known from the work of Michael Green and collaborators. So we'll sort of see these two types of expansions in the field theory as well, in the 4D n equal 4 supraangular theory as well. Okay, so that was the scattering amplitude. Now let me talk about the CFT correlator. So in n equal 4 supraangulars, just to be concrete, let's just focus on the scalar operators in the same multiplet as the stress energy tensor, which are the operators transform in the 20 prime representation of the SO6 R symmetry. In terms of the scalars, the 6 scalars of n equal 4 supraangulars, this would be trace phi I phi j. Type operators. As I said before, at large n and lambda, this is dual to string theory on 85 times this 5. Lambda is related to the radius of ADS divided by the string length, and Jiang Mills is related to the string coupling. So just as we expanded the flat space scattering amplitude, we can now expand the four-point function of these operators. It's a double expansion. In 1 over n and 1 over lambda. Instead of 1 over n in this talk, I will use 1 over c, where c is the central charge. It's z squared minus 1 divided by 4. So what does this expansion look like? There's some disconnected piece to this correlator. And then there's a term that goes like 1 over c. It has an expansion in 1 over lambda, then 1 over c squared, then 1 over c cubed, and so on. 1 over c is tree level. And the first term here, so here I didn't write down the function of position, just the dependence on C and lambda. This term that doesn't scale with lambda comes from the supergravity contribution. The one that goes like 1/(λ^3/2) comes from the r^4 contribution. The next one is d^4 r^4, and so on. Remember that r^4 had 6 more derivatives compared to the Einstein-Hilbert term. And so 6 more derivatives means l^6. So l^6 is λ^3/2. That's the reason why it's suppressed by 1/(λ^3/2). And then the next one has d^4 r^4 that has 10 more derivatives and it's suppressed by 1/(λ^5/2) compared to the supergravity term. And then as I said before, in that case, there was, so here there's also a high order in GS. There are analytic terms and non-analytic terms in STU. There's another analytic term that gets paired up with this ls^6 and gets combined into this, corresponds to the second term in this Eisenstein series. So that would be this term here that goes like 1/(c^2)λ^1/2). And then this one here gets paired up with that. So you can think of these terms in the ones, all the ones in blue and all the ones in green as corresponding to r^4 and d^4 r^4, but with different dependence on the string coupling in the flat space limit. So right now, we know all these terms, all the ones that are in colors, we know them completely, including all the constants. Okay. So this is sort of what I want to explain in a little more detail how that is determined. Okay, so two comments before I explain the computation. The first comment is that one can.
Can you show again the definition of the Eisenstein series? Sorry, previous
one. Yeah.
So the dependence on G string just factored out?
No, tau is chi plus I over G string, where chi is the expectation value of the axion. No. Yeah, otherwise that wouldn't be this formula. okay, good. So as I said before, one can compute this four-point function to the orders I mentioned, even though the higher derivative corrections to supergravity are not completely known. Even though we don't know, we wouldn't know what Witten diagrams to write down, we can still figure out the answer of those Witten diagram computations. And we can also consider an expansion that's similar to that Eisenstein series, the expansion that had the Eisenstein series in flat space. And that would be, I'd call that a very strong coupling expansion. It would be a large N expansion at fixed Jiang Mills. So in that case, the four-point function looks like has some disconnected piece. Then it's an expansion just in 1/N where the coefficients could possibly depend on Jiang Mills. So the first term is the supergravity term. It has a goes like 1/C. The next one corresponds to r^4. It goes like 1/(c^7/4), and it's a function of Jiang Mills. Then this is the supergravity one loop term. Then this is then there's d^4 r^4, some function of Jiang Mills divided by c^9/4, and so on. So these functions of Jiang Mills that are here should involve, will involve Eisenstein series. Okay. All right. So let me say this in more detail. N equal 4 superang Mills. I said sort of said this before. Field content is some gauge fields, fermions, and 6 scalars in the 6-dimensional representation of the S^2^4 symmetry. And it has single trace operators that are of the form trace phi to the p of scaling dimension delta equals to p. And they transform in the representation 0p0 of the S^2^4 symmetry. The four-point functions of these operators are simplest operators in N equal 4 superang Mills theory. Their four-point functions have been extensively studied from the beginning of the ADS-CFT correspondence. And in the supergravity limit, the full answer is known due to Rostelli and Zhao. In this talk, we'll go beyond the supergravity limit. And because we'll go beyond the supergravity limit, I won't be able to do this in general. And for now, I'll just talk about the four-point function, as I said before, of the 20 prime operator, which is this S2. So the four-point function of S2. Now, conformal symmetry and SU4R symmetry imply that this four-point function takes this form. There's the prefactor and then some functions of u and v. Why are there more functions as opposed to just one function? Well, because these operators have indices, and there are six possible ways of contracting their SO6 or SU4 indices in order to get singlets. So there are six functions of u and v in this four-point function. Now, the six functions are not independent because they're restricted by supersymmetry. The supersymmetric word identities imply algebraic relations between the six functions of u and v. It's algebraic relations only in the case of n equal 4 super Young Mills. In other cases, the relations would not be algebraic. So in this case, all these functions can be written in terms of a single function that I'll call t of u and v. So roughly, this four-point function is the expression that you'd have in the free theory times this prefactor times various simple functions of u and v, like v, u, v, u, and so on, times this function t of u and v. So the full information in this four-point function is contained in only one function, t of u and v. And as I said before, this is special for the n equal 4 supersymmetry. So in order to figure out what the four-point function is, I just have to figure out t. As I said at the beginning, it's easier to think about it in Mellin space, where contact Witten diagrams give polynomial Mellin amplitudes, and exchange Witten diagrams give Mellin amplitudes with poles. So we can Mellin transform this function, just this function t, and the Mellin amplitude corresponding to it is just some m of s and t. And then MSNT of SNT can be determined, as I said before, up to a few constants using its properties being crossing symmetry. The crossing symmetry of the four-point function implies that M of SNT is the same of M of SNU, and M of SNT is the same of M of UNT. It has a given pole structure if we think about tree-level Witten diagrams that explain what the pole structure was. And it has some given asymptotic growth, a large S and T. So with these constraints, the most general answer is given by this. So M of S and T, this is just a leading order in the 1 over C expansion. And then at this order, I'm expanding in 1 over lambda. OK? So this is the supergravity term, completely fixed. And then the next term corresponding to r to the 4, the coefficient is unfixed, but we know it should be. So all these terms that correspond to r to the 4, d to the 4, r to the 4, and so on, should just be polynomials in STNU, and they should be symmetric. So there aren't that many possibilities. So this one, at order 1 over lambda to the 3 halves, is known up to a constant. At the next order, there's like two constants we need to determine. At the next order, there would be more constants that we need to determine, and so on. Okay. So this would be like the full correlator up to that order. And as I said before, the constraints on what these constants are come from either the flat space limit or supersymmetric localization. And the flat space limit one is simple because it just relates, the flat space limit relates this Mellin amplitude M that is the Mellin transform of the function t. That's the only function that appears in the correlator. So it relates this to the function f that I had over here, to this function of s and t. And the relation between them is given by this. So you just take m, evaluate it at these values, do this integral, take the large L limit, or take L to infinity, keeping L string fixed. And then you get the function f of s and t that I wrote before. As I said, so at each order, it's only the leading term in the expansion because here we're evaluating the Mellin amplitude as some value of s and t that's proportional to L squared, and then you would take L to infinity. It's only the leading term that contributes to the flat space limit. So from the flat space limit, we should determine that we should be able to say at each order what the leading term is in the Mellin amplitude. So from the flat space limit, we can figure out right away what C1 is. C1 would be 15 zeta of 3. And we can figure out right away what C2 is. C2 would be 315 over 4 is 805, and then so on. Okay? So already with just the flat space limit, we could figure out the expansion. We can figure out the first correction through supergravity to this four-point function. To figure out more terms, so in particular to determine the value of C3, we have to use other constraints. And in particular, I'll explain now how to use supersymmetric localization constraints. Okay. Now, computing correlation functions of operators at separated points using supersymmetric localization is not easy. And the reason for that, to tell you what the reason is, let me first explain very briefly what supersymmetric localization does. So it gives exact results in supersymmetric theories, but generally not for correlation functions of local operators. The idea of supersymmetric localization is that if we start with some theory, so suppose we have some path integral, and then we add to the action, we add anti-commutator of Q with some operator in such a way that that we choose that operator in such a way that the bosonic part of this operator is positive definite, then we can take the T to be very large. And when we take T to be very large, this integral localizes to configurations where Q psi is zero. It's important that this integral, because of supersymmetry, this integral is independent of T. So then we can take T large and get the full answer. So this integral gets reduced to a simpler integral over the locus X such that the anti-commutator of Q and psi is zero. And then we have e to the minus s. And then we have a one loop determinant of fluctuations around this locus. Ideally, what we'd get after this would be a finite dimensional integral so that we can compute it. The same idea works if in here we insert observables that are invariant under Q. We can do the same procedure, and then it would be, so if here we had a finite dimensional integral, we'd have with additional insertions in this finite dimensional integral. But generically, these Q invariant observables are not local operators. The reason for that is the following. Local operators are not invariant under Q. Because Q squared is usually a translation plus some R symmetry transformation. And Q O being zero means that Q squared O would also have to be zero. But if Q squared is a translation, then Q squared O would generally not be zero. Would act on O by Q squared would act on O by a translation. So usually this method is a little hard to apply to local operators. So then we have two options. One option is to not look at local operators. For instance, we look at operators that are integrated over the full space. Or we can look at local operators that are inserted at special points. And those special points are the points where Q squared is zero. So these are the two options. And in this talk, we'll use both. So we want to compute this four-point function S2, 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 S2. We'll take two of the S2s, and we will relate them. Well, we'll take two of the S2s, and we'll integrate them. And then we'll put the other S2s at points where Q squared is 0. So what is the setup? We want to study n equal 4 superangmules in flat space. N equal 4 superangmules is a conformal field theory. So we can take it, instead of studying it on flat space, we can study it on a round 4 sphere. Now, on a round 4 sphere, we can deform the theory by while preserving some supercharge that belongs to an n equal 2 subalgebra of the n equal 4 algebra. This is the setup that was considered by Pestun when he localized n equal 4 superangmules on S4. And this Q squared is 0 only at the north and the south poles of S4. So We'll take two of these operators, two of these S2s, and we'll put one of the north pole, one of the south pole, and the other ones we'll be integrating. Okay, so let me explain in a little more detail what these operators are. Because the supercharge here preserves an n=2subalgebra, it is a part of an n=2 subalgebra, let me have one slide on two different kinds of supermultiplets that are present, that could be present in a general n=2 superconformal field theory. So in an n=2 superconformal field theory, could have, if it has global, so it has the R symmetry is SU2 times U1. In the case of the n=4 supranimals theory, this would be a subalgebra of SU4. And if the n=2 superconformal field theory has a flavor symmetry, then it has a conserved current, and the conserved current has to come in the same multiplet as other operators. And in particular, one of the operators will be an operator called J, which has dimension 2. And it transforms in the three-dimensional representation of this SU2 R symmetry, and it's a singlet under U1. And it has some other operator K that has dimension 3, that's a singlet under SU2, but it has some charge under U1. These operators will appear in the bottom of the slide. Okay? And so that's one kind of multiplet that's present in 4D n=2 superconformal field theories. Another kind of multiplet is a chiral or anti-chiral multiplet. I'm not going to write down the full operator content of the multiplet, but the superconformal primary would be a scalar of dimension equal to p. That's a singlet under this SU2 R, but it's charged under U1, and the charge is plus or minus p, depending on whether it's chiral or anti-chiral. Here, we'll be interested in the case p equal 2, just so that you have a specific value of p in mind. Okay. So on S4, there are two deformations that preserve the supercharge that I mentioned on the previous slide. One is the real mass deformation, where to the action we add a term that's proportional to m, and then it has a linear combination of these scalars, of this scalar of dimension 2 and the scalar of dimension 3. This will come with the dimension 2 one come with a factor of 1 over the radius of the sphere. So this is one deformation that preserves the supercharge, and another one is we can insert chiral operator at the north pole or an anti-chiral operator at the south pole. Or we could do both of these deformations. Okay? And this still preserves the supercharge. Okay, how does this apply to the n=4 superyang mills? Well, we're interested in this 20 prime operator. So we should think about what this 20 prime operator would be from the point of view of an n=2 superconformal field theory. So here, the R symmetry of the n=2 superconformal field theory would be SU2 times U1. It's embedded in this SU4, but there's an SU2 flavor symmetry. So there's so there would be then a conserved current multiplet, and these operators J and K that belong to the same super multiplet as the flavor current. And the 20 prime will contain the J. The 20 prime is a dimension, these are dimension 2 operators, and J had dimension 2. So part of the 20 prime is this J. And also part of the 20 prime are these chiral and anti-chiral operators, A2 and A2 bar. So then we can consider the n=4 superyang mills theory on S4. And then to it, we can deform it by adding this A2 operator at the north pole, A2 bar at the south pole, and then we can have this ij plus k with coefficient m. The point of doing this is that we can compute what the partition function is as a function of delta tau bar, and m. And then we can relate that to correlation functions at separated points. And here, tau is the complexified gauge coupler. Now, as shown by Jaume, up to Q exact terms, this operators that are put either at the north pole or the south pole are the same as some operators that are integrated over the whole sphere. What are those operators? Those are exactly the operators that we generate if we were to change the complexified gauge coupling by a little bit. So what that says is that if we want to compute the partition function, which is a function of the complexified gauge coupling, tau and tau bar, as well as the sources for these operators that we insert at the north pole and the south pole, as well as the mass, is the same thing as just computing the partition function as a function of tau plus delta tau and tau bar plus delta tau bar. So it is enough to compute the partition function as a function of the complexified gauge coupling and the mass. But this is exactly what Pestun did. He computed this partition function as a function of tau, tau bar, and m. This is the same thing as, this is what's called the n equal 2 star theory. So this is the answer for the S4 partition function as a function of tau, tau bar, and the mass. It's some integral, it's an n minus 1 dimensional integral. It's the gauge coupling appears over here. The function that's being integrated is a little complicated. It's the product of two Barnes G functions. It's not that we just have this integral. We also have some instanton contributions from the north pole and the south pole of the four sphere. So what happened for Pestun was that the scalars in the vector multiple localized to some constant values, which are just these A's, but they're also instantons of the north pole and the south pole. If we're just interested in the perturbative expansion at large n, in fixed lambda, one can ignore the instantons. So then it's just this integral that one has to compute. Okay? So then why am I doing this? Because I want to relate this to a four-point function. How do we relate this to a four-point function? Well, we take four derivatives with respect to the coupler. So we can take two derivatives with respect to the mass, one derivative with respect to tau, and one derivative with respect to tau bar, and that set the mass to zero. And this should be the same as having A2 at the north pole, A2 bar at the south pole, and then this ij plus k operator integrated over the whole four sphere. Now, using word identities and integration, some integrations by parts and some group theory to relate A, A bar, J, and K to the operators in the n equal 4 superangular theory, one can see what this relation means in the language that in which I described the four-point function before. So before I said the four-point function of this S2 operator depends only on a single function of U and V, which I call T. So then this quantity over here should also be written in terms of T. And it's a two-dimensional integral, and it's exactly this two-dimensional integral. Okay? And it's highly non-trivial to derive this equation. Derivation is a little long. Now, using Pestun's formula, which is over here, we can also compute this quantity. So this is this fourth derivative that I mentioned, normalized by the second derivative. At leading order in 1 over n or in 1 over c, it's given by this expansion. So then how do we use this? Well, we had the Mellin amplitude written in terms of a few numerical constants that we didn't know. From that, we can compute what T is. From that, we can do this integral. We're going to get an answer in terms of these constants that we didn't know. But then we know the right-hand side. So we expand both the left-hand side and the right-hand side in 1 over lambda and then match it. So doing that, one obtains that C1 is 15 times 8 of 3. And then one obtains some relation between C2 and C3. So 64 C2 plus 28 C3 is given by this number, and then so on. So at each order in the 1 over lambda expansion, this supersymmetric localization constraint gives one relation between the undetermined constants.
Can we understand these constants directly in flat space by thinking of the ones which are not the leading powers in S as some kind of deformation of starting to see ADS appearing? For example, scattering not just 2 to 2, but 2 to 2 plus some soft gravitons.
I would think that, although that, I would
take some kind of limit of the 6-point function and then find directly the theta 5, for example. Would you just try it?
No, we didn't try this. I don't know how to make this precise, but morally, this is what should happen. Yes. Yeah. So comments. This C1 was derived in two ways. One way was just directly by comparing with the flat space limit, and the other way was using supersymmetric localization. So that means that because we derived it in two ways and we got the same answer, this is a check of ADS-CFT beyond the supergravity approximation. And the other one is combining the flat space limit with localization. We can actually determine completely what C2 and C3 are, and they're given by this. To fully fix all the constants at higher orders in the tree level 1 over lambda expansion, one would need more constraints. There are potentially more constraints one can find using supersymmetric localization. For instance, we can take 4 derivatives of the partition function with respect to the mass, not 2 derivatives with respect to the mass and 2 derivatives with respect to the coupler. Or I can look at the theory on a square sphere. Or, there's some other constraints that one can use that we haven't used. So one can go a little further using this. Okay, one can generalize this to S2, S2, SP, SP, where SP was raised phi to the P. That's just because SP contains n equal 2 chiral or anti-chiral multiplets viewed from the n equal 2 point of view, where scalar operators are AP and AP bar that can be inserted at north and south poles of S4. And the n equal 2 star partition function further deformed by these insertions can also be computed. And for instance, the fourth derivative with respect to 2 derivatives with respect to the mass, 1 derivative with respect to the coupling for this AP, and the other one coupling for AP bar is given by this expression. It's a very, very simple formula, in the grand scheme of things. So one can also generalize it to that case. And let me show you what the answer is. So in this case, the Mellin amplitude depends on P, and it's just some complicated function of P. And again, the 1 over lambda to the 3/2 term here can be derived in 2 different ways. So this is another check of ABS-CFT. So far, this was in the Tuft strong coupling limit. One can also consider it a very strong coupling limit, where one sends n to infinity and keeps Jiang-Mills fixed. So in this case, the Mellin amplitude, so the leading term is supergravity. The next term is this r^4, or some coefficient that's a function of the Jiang-Mills coupling. And then the one loop term, and then something corresponding to d^4 r^4, where we have potentially 2 functions of the Jiang-Mills coupling, and so on. So now comparison with a flat space limit would determine that this b^tau is proportional to an Eisenstein series. So proportional to this e^3/2. And this implies something about the S4 partition function. Something about the second derivative of the S4 partition function evaluated when the mass is 0, expanded in 1 over n at fixed Jiang-Mills, the second term in the expansion should have this Eisenstein series, e^3/2. This is a highly non-trivial fact about the S4 partition function. And to check it, from Pestun's localization formula, one would have to understand the sum over instantons. Should I take 5 more minutes to say something about ABJM, or should I stop?
5 minutes?
Okay. Is that fine?
For me, personally. But yeah. I just have a question. So
yeah.
How much of this could you do already from the n equals 2 theory? If you're using localization from the n equals 2 theory,
yeah.
Could you also try to bootstrap the Mellin amplitude for the n equals 2 theory at strong coupling?
Yeah, the question is the Mellin amplitude of what? If we want the stress tensor multiplet, the stress tensor multiplet in that case is not half BPS. So one would have to understand the supersymmetric word identities on it. And that's a little hard. Yeah. Oh, jeez.
It's a sign.
Maybe I should stop. I can just say very briefly. So in ABJM theory, we have 2 parameters, n and k. Instead of n, we can use the analog of c, which is the coefficient in the 2-point function of the stress tensor. I'll call that ct. And there are 2 cases. One case is when k is 1 or 2, and we take the large n limit, and the theory has n equal 8 supersymmetry, and the dual is in 11 dimensions. And in that case, we can compute the 4-point function. We can expand it in 1 over ct. So again, this is the tree-level supergravity. This is r^4. This is one loop. This is d^4 r^4. This is d^6 r^4. And so on. This d^4 r^4 comes with a coefficient that actually is 0. This should be a 0, not a 1. It's allowed by supersymmetry, but it's known to vanish. Okay? And we can do the same procedure. We can apply this analytic bootstrap. And for the R to the 4 one, we get one polynomial solution, so one constant to determine. For this one, we get two constants to determine. For this one, three constants, and so on. And we can determine this constant using a flat space limit or supersymmetric localization. In this case, we know the S3 partition function is a function of two masses. And it's actually known to all orders in the 1 over n expansion. And we can use the derivative with respect to only one mass or derivative with respect to two masses to fix the terms up to here. Okay? If we want to further use the flat space limit, we can also fix this term over here. Now, in the other case where we take n to infinity, keeping lambda fixed, which is n over k, we have type 2a on ADS4 times CP3. In this case, so we can define lambda and g string, which are related to L over LS, and also to lambda and CT. And in this case, too, we can consider the four-point function, but because in this case, the stress tensor multiple does not have BPS, it's only a third BPS. The constraints from supersymmetry are much weaker. And if we write the four-point function at order 1 over CT, we have the supergravity term. And then at order 1 over lambda to the 3 halves, which correspond to R to the 4, we have, after a lot of work, we're left with only two polynomial solutions. So there are two coefficients to be fixed, as opposed to the n equal 8 case where this was just one polynomial solution. So in this case, we can fix it only up to this order. All right, so to conclude, the combination of techniques, which is supersymmetric localization, word identities, analytic bootstrap, and Mellin space, can be used to study holographic correlators beyond the supergravity approximation in both 4D n equal 4 supergravity Mills and 3D ABGM theory. And for the future, we can explore other constraints coming from supersymmetric localization. For instance, we can put theories on squash spheres. We can take more derivative respect to the mass. All derivative in the n equal 4 case, we can take 4 derivative respect to the mass. We haven't discussed that. We can look at loops. We can look at the loop amplitudes. And another thing one can do is to combine these integrated constraints. So the integrated constraints can also be used potentially, combine it with a numerical bootstrap. That's all. Thank you.
So now we have a time for question and discussion. Any question to the table? So I have a question for ABJM case. So if you so such as 35 dimensional operators now. You are computing some correlators. So what types of so insertion of the hemisphere in this case? Kairou and Hatch-Kairou as well?
No, so in this case, in the ABJM case, you can just compute the partition function as the function of masses. So you just have all four operators be integrated operators.
And why to the mass parameters in ABJM?
So ABJM has three mass parameters. Depending on the presentation, you can think of them as an FI parameter. So these would be the two math parameters that preserve n equal 4 supersymmetry.
So it's three dimensions. We have SU2 triplet and SU2 triplet, right? So if I
yes, yes, yes.
In this case, in one M2, the triplet under the SU2H.
Sorry?
So the triplet under the SU2H.
Yes. One of them under SU2H and the other one under SU2C. The R symmetry is SU2H times SU2C. That's right. So it's just some certain component that you can turn on the sphere. It's the two parameters that we're discussing before lunch.
Yes.
Yeah.
Any other questions? So if not, let's thank Sylvia again.